Hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local band members and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with Keith Follesay. Hello, this is Tom Campbell. Today is July 19th, 2012, and I'm talking with songwriter Keith Follesay. Keith, what is your full name, your date of birth, and your hometown, please?
Keith Follesay, 41651, Golden Valley, Minnesota.
Where did you go to high school and what year did you graduate?
Robbinsdale High, 1969.
And what's your early recollection of songwriting and being in a band and becoming interested in music?
Well, like we were speaking about a little while ago, as a young kid, I always had songs in my head. My mother said, as early as 5 years old, I said, "You know, Mom, those little songs that are rolling around in your head, would you save them for me? Because I'm keeping them too." And I made up poems as a kid. And by the time I was about 12, I was writing songs and I was making up songs. Yeah. There was a couple neighborhood kids, Louie and Jerry Lenz. They lived over about a block, and Louie played guitar, and Jerry played organ. They had an organ in their living room, and they wanted to have a band, and they knew I loved the Beatles. They said, "Maybe you could be the drummer."
Really?
And I said, "Well, I don't have any drums." They said, "Well, why don't you talk to your mom?" So my mom agreed to let me rent a snare drum from Schmidt Music, and I was going to be in the band at school and play the snare drum, and I became the drummer. Well, that lasted about 2 weeks because Louie's dad bought Jerry a set of drums. So Jerry became the drummer. But they were too nice to kick me out of the band, and since I could play keyboard, they said, "You become the organ player." So even as soon as the very beginning of the band, Jerry and I were still trading off on drums and organ. But it soon became apparent that he was a better drummer than me, and I played keyboard, not necessarily better, but that's what I could play at the time.
Did the band eventually have a name?
The band became the Wailing Phantoms. Louie knew a friend named Scott Jeffy, who became the bass player. And Scott was cool because his parents were from England, and so everybody liked the Beatles. And Scott got a Hofner bass, as I recall. The very beginnings of the band, I still recall this like it was yesterday. Jerry and I were like buddy-buddy. And Louie and Scott were much older. They were 3 or 4 years older. We would come home on the bus every day from Carl Sandburg Junior High School. And I would play organ and he would play drums. And we would practice for about 2 hours. I'd go home, have dinner, and come back to their house and practice all night again. And that's all I did in junior high and high school is practice. That's all we ever did. Every Saturday, we'd take the bus downtown to Schmidt Music, look at the top 40, and buy a single or two of whatever had just come out. And we were just obsessed with music.
Did the Wailing Phantoms play any jobs?
We did some eighth grade parties. And I can't remember if we ever really literally played in a place that, like, the Robbinsdale Youth Center or anything. We might have done the VFW Hall. The Wailing Phantoms became the Enchanters. I know why we changed our name. That, by the way, that's the Enchanters. The Enchanters. I am not sure why we became the Enchanters. But back in those days, I do remember this. I had a home. My mother made me work for it, but I got an organ. It wasn't even a Hammond, which was really sucked because everybody wanted a Hammond. And it was like a Laurie or something like that. And we carried it around. I mean, we carried around a home organ to wherever we played. And it was real. We had like 4 or 5 guys lifting this organ up and carrying it around. Mm. And I think it was in about eighth grade, I had my appendix out. And there was a kid next to me that had his out as well. He was from St. Louis Park. His name was Timmy Guerin. And I ended up running into Timmy Guerin in L.A. years later. Timmy played guitar and sang like a little bird. And I was so envious that he could play guitar. And I said to my mom, "I've got to get a guitar." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "There's just different songs in guitars, Mom. And I'm starting to write songs and I need a guitar." So they got me a Mexican guitar for like $25. And I taught myself how to play guitar.
So you did both in the Enchanters?
Yeah, I ended up playing both instruments in the Enchanters and the Wailing Fan, or the Wailing Phantoms and the Enchanters. I think probably but the Enchanters. I think in the Wailing Phantoms, I was lucky to play organ. To be honest with you, I was pretty much self-taught. I had a few piano lessons, but I never paid attention to them. And you know, we all back then, we all just learned stuff off records. I mean, that's what everybody did. That's what we did.
In the Enchanters and the Wailing Phantoms, were the bands playing your original songs?
Yeah, I'm sure we were, because I was writing songs from the time I was 12 and 13 years old. I wrote a lot. That was my passion. It was my obsession. My mother ran my dad's electrical business. She did the bookwork for my father. We had four kids and a number of foster kids. Sometimes we had as many as six kids around the house. So in order for her to have the time, in those days you could get help. You could hire an English girl. You flew her over, and they paid her, I think it was just a few hundred dollars a month, and she got room and board. She got a chance to see America, and she would take care of us kids during the day. And the one that we had, her boyfriend in England managed the Searchers, Needles and Pinza, and Sonny Bono. And I didn't know that until about 4 years ago, and that he wrote that. We would get the pop papers from England, and I saw the Beatles, and I was very enamored with these pictures, and they sent a record over, and I knew who the Beatles were a year and a half before they broke in America. I could play all their songs. I was just a complete Beatle freak, like every other kid in our generation was, I guess. We all were, I think. And so anyway, that made me want to write songs, because they wrote songs. And, you know, they were one of the first bands that it was such an obvious singer-songwriter band, because before then, you know, most of the bands, Chuck Berry wrote songs, but I don't think people knew that. You know, this was a big deal. The Beatles wrote their songs. That's the first I remember that.
Do you recall playing at Breezy Point with the Enchanters in the summer of 65?
I do, because Jerry and Louie's uncle were some sort of owner in the place, and that's the only way we would have gotten the gig, because we probably weren't very good, and we did play up there, and it was a lot of fun. In fact, I'm going to Brainerd tomorrow for the first time probably since then.
Wow.
And I'm going up with my brother to play golf. And I'm looking very forward to seeing what it looks like up there nowadays.
Oh, it's changed.
That's what I hear.
So at some point here, I have late 1966 that you left the Enchanters. What happens at that point?
I wanted, because of my love for the Beatles, I wanted to be in a harmony band, a band that sang. And the Enchanters, we probably weren't terrible, but we played more like the Dave Clark Five and the Animals, those kinds of things, because I played organ, so dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, I played those songs, you know. But I really was getting into my guitar, and I loved the Beatles. And I'd heard about this band called the Lynx that sang all Beatles songs, and they were really supposed to be great, and I'd heard them. I caught just the end of them playing somewhere.
By any chance, would that have been at the teen fair, at the state fair?
Maybe. It might have been.
The band did play at the B-sharp music tent.
Well, I went to B-sharp all the time like every other kid did and dealt with George Lopez or whatever his name was.
Jim
Lopez. And I bought my first Tremolux from Jim Lopez. And I'll tell you a story about my first compact organ, too, in a minute here. That's pretty good.
But you saw the Lynx somewhere.
I saw them, and then I'd heard it was a tragedy. Gary's brother passed away. He got killed in a car accident. And I heard that the band just didn't play anymore. And I had to dig around and ask a few people. I can't remember if I asked Phil Birdall or who I asked, but I got Randy Johnson's phone number. I literally bugged Randy Johnson. Randy had a beautiful girlfriend, and I think he was more involved in his girlfriend than he was in being in the band. And probably looking back, pretty down about what happened to John, you know, and it hadn't been that long, maybe 6, 8, 10 months. I said, you know, I'd really like to get a band going with you guys, and da-da-da. And Randy didn't seem that interested, but I called him, like, I think at least 3 or 4 times. And finally, I think just to get me to stop pestering him, he brought Gary over to my house, and I could actually play a piano, and I think they were fairly shocked. I don't think they thought I could play anything. And so they thought, well, maybe we'll try this. So we formed this band, and I was in heaven because we were playing all Beatles songs and my songs. And that's what I wanted to do.
So that's the first version of The Youngsters. And just for the record, who's in the first version of the band?
Gary's playing bass, Gary Lopak. Randy Johnson's playing guitar. I'm playing guitar and organ at that time, still the one that I dragged around, the big one. Tom Lang is playing drums.
Okay.
Here's the organ story. It's pretty good. My grandmother, God rest her soul, my grandmother always thought I would make it in the music business. She told my mother that I was going to be famous someday, which is not true, but she always thought I would make it. And she would come to our jobs, even up at the rec center in Robbinsdale and wherever we played, my grandma would come out and listen to us. And we couldn't have been very good, and we had to be loud, I'm sure. She watched us drag that organ around. And I wanted, you know, they came out with a Farfisa Combo Compact, and they sounded terrible, but I wanted one in the worst way because I didn't want to carry that thing around anymore. And my grandma comes up to me one day and she says, "Keith, how much is an organ like that?" And I said, $444 at B sharp. And she said, "Here's a check for the organ. Don't tell your mother I gave this to you." So how's my mom going to think I got $444? But I was so excited, and I got a combo compact. And you've got pictures of me with that thing. And that was really an exciting thing, and a Tremolex amp to play it through. So, and then we used that for a long time. I ended up getting a Vox Continental because it sounded a lot more like a Hammond, and I liked that a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Youngsters go into the studio at some point in, I believe it's 1967, and record, which I would assume would be your first recordings of your original song.
Yeah, I think back then we did anywhere between 10 and 15, 20 of my songs. You know, I would bring them in when I wrote them, and we would kind of play them, and if the guys all liked them, we would play them. We went in and recorded these two songs. I remember that.
Which two did you pick?
We did You've Been Telling Lies and You Said Goodbye. And if you listen to You've Been Telling Lies, you can tell we like the Beatles. You Said Goodbye was, I remember I wrote that on the keyboard instead of the guitar. And it had a little bit different sound to it than You've Been Telling Lies did. And these were just a couple. I was talking to Gary just today, and he told me he's got a recording of us playing a song that I wrote just live in the basement that's pretty good, that I forgot I had even written.
By any chance, is that called I Love You So?
Yeah, he was telling me about that.
He played it for me.
Yeah.
What do you recall about that recording session?
Well, we'd never been in a studio before. It was 4-track. Or was it 8? It was a Scully machine, I remember that. I'd never, you know, even seen a booth or a place to sit. I had no idea what it was going to be like. They just had us play through the song and then sing it and stuff, and I learned what overdubbing was, which I did not know, and I've since learned a ton about those machines, and I've read, you know, Jeff Emmerich's book just like everybody else has, and I know a lot about those early Scully machines and stuff like that.
Was that at Dove Studio in Bloomington?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
And was Pete Steinberg there doing the engineering?
Yes, he was.
So you had an audition with Marsh, I understand.
Somewhere in South Minneapolis at a barn, I think. Back in those days, Marsh was the big booker, and I remember he charged more than other people, but he got you better jobs. There was Central Booking and there was Marsh mm-hmm. Productions, and for whatever reason you wanted to be with Marsh. I don't know why, he's such a crazy guy, but we wanted to audition because we wanted more jobs. We could only get the teen centers that we could get mm-hmm. and stuff. And I remember we went out and we played for him. And I think he had no idea that we could sing as well as we could. And we were based on harmonies. I mean, we three-part everything. And we sang him a couple songs, and I remember him saying, "You guys are really good, but you're going to have to learn to play stuff that people can dance to, like R&B. And I said, "R and what?" and he said, "Like the Temptations and the Four Tops." And I said, "Who are they?" I mean, I literally didn't know. And I knew who the Shirelles and the Ronettes and people that they played on mainstream white American top 40 radio, but I didn't know all the R&B groups, which became one of my favorite kinds of music after a few years. I mean, I really loved that stuff, and I'm not supposed to talk forward, but I'll tell you a story about that later on. I've written with some pretty famous guys, Holland Dozier and Holland. I wrote with Lamont Dozier.
When this record comes out, what happened with it? What did you do with the record?
I don't think we did anything with it. I think we just made it because we wanted to do it. My mother actually paid, I think it was a couple $100 or $300. My mother loved my songs. My mother's always been my biggest fan, thank God, because I wouldn't be where I am without my mother. She wanted us to make a record. I think it was her idea, to be honest with you.
Okay. Then shortly after that, actually I have 1969. Another 45 comes out by the Youngsters. What's the story behind the Candy Apple 45?
Well, we got that audition passed with Marsh, and he started booking us, and we started playing a lot at local places, Mr. Lucky's, Magoo's, and I think we started to get a pretty good following. The band was fairly popular. I mean, whenever we played Lucky's and Magoo's, it was full, so I can only go by that. I think we were liked by whoever paid attention to the Youngsters, and I met a guy named David Sandler. I can't remember how I met David, but David and I connected on a musical level. He really liked that I wrote songs because he wrote songs, and we would compare songs that we wrote and stuff, and he liked commercial music and stuff, and I think I played him Candy Apple, which I had kind of written for the fun of it, just to see if I could write a song, because bubblegum music was on the radio, and I thought it was kind of silly, and I just thought I'd see if I could do it. And he said, you know, I think this song is great. We should go in and record this song. I think I could get, you know, put out. So I think it was at his doing and his behest that we went in and actually did this, and he said, well, do you have something for the B-side? And I played him a number of songs that I'd written, and he really liked this big ballad that I'd written about some girl I was in love with in high school, and you mm-hmm. know, we had one that we were in love with every 2 weeks, and I can't even remember the girl. And Charlie sang I Don't Stand a Chance, and Charlie was in the band then, and Charlie was a great singer.
And was it Sandler's idea to use studio musicians on?
Yeah, it was his idea. He was producing it, and I didn't even know what a producer was at that point. I mean, mm-hmm. I just was a songwriter in a band.
So basically, you guys are in there doing the vocals.
Yeah, I can't remember if I played anything. I think I played something. It seems like I played something, because I think I played some keyboards or something, but because they were my songs. But yeah, we sang them, that's for sure.
And the label, Blueberry Sunshine, whose label is that?
That was a made-up label that I think David made up. I think he did. Either he did or I did. I can't remember for sure.
So how'd this 45 do? Did you get any airplay around town?
Little around town, and I think David somehow... David's dad was in the, like, the pinball gaming business, pinball machines and things like that. And I think his family was friends with the Heilickers. And I knew that the Heilickers were in the music business, but I didn't understand what they did at the time. And I think through Ira or somebody, David hooked it up with a New York label, Jubilee, and we got a release, but I don't think it ever did anything.
Jubilee was a national label? Or?
Yes, they were out of New York. It was a national label.
Okay, so what happens with the Youngsters?
The Youngsters went through some different changes. Gary was so young when we started that his voice had not changed. And Gary could sing so high that we used to do Want Somebody to Love by Jefferson Airplane, and he sang the Gray Slick part in his real voice. But I'll never forget the day, some arena in St. Paul, we're playing, and all of a sudden, he just can't sing high anymore. So all these harmonies that we had are gone. We have no more harmonies. The kid can't sing high. So he was our tenor. And I sang the middle parts, and Randy sang all the low parts. And Randy is a natural harmony singer. So I thought, what are we going to do? I heard about this kid at school that could sing Charlie Allen, and I heard him singing in choir. And I thought, man, this kid, he's got a high voice, and he can really sing. So I kept trying to talk Charlie into being in the band, but Charlie's cousin was the state wrestling champ, and Charlie wanted to be the state wrestling champ, and I kept saying, no, dude, you gotta sing. I kept trying to talk him into coming over to practice. He finally came over to practice, and I think he liked the band, but I think the kicker was he broke his leg, so he couldn't wrestle anymore. So when he couldn't wrestle, I had him. So he joined the band, and once we got him back, he could sing the high parts and Gary could sing just down a little bit. And so then we had four part harmony, and that was the best youngster vocal group that we had, because we really could sing with four part harmony. I think it was just after high school, Randy went into the service, and somewhere along the line, we changed drummers. I don't remember. Randy knew Tom Holt, and I'm not sure why Tom Lang left the band. I can't remember, but Tom Holt became a member of the band shortly after Charlie got in. And then Randy, who I think knew Tom, left the band, and Jeff Hill joined the band. Jeff didn't sing, so we went from four-part to three-part. Tom Holt sang an occasional song in a little bit of harmony, but we weren't maybe as good vocally, but Jeff was a tremendous guitar player. So what Randy couldn't do as a lead player, but could sing great, Jeff didn't sing, but really played some great guitar. So we were a little different band then. We did more R&B. Charlie was a real natural. Like, we also went in and recorded Higher and Higher later on at some point with Charlie singing. And I've got a recording of that. And I can't remember who. I think that was us. Yeah, I think it was. It might not have been the youngsters. I'm not sure who was in the band, but I have a recording with Charlie singing Higher and Higher.
That's the Jackie Wilson song?
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure Gary played on that too. Okay. Now we never put it up, but I think I can get your recording of it. And Charlie was just a great singer. I mean, that kid he should have been black. I mean, he sang like he was black.
And how long do the youngsters last?
You know, I didn't know until I looked at your chronography, because it seemed like a lot longer to me than it was, but I guess it was a bit over 3 years. But honestly, looking back at it, it seemed like 7 or 8, you know, because it was my whole life. But I think it was only just a few years.
So we have July 31st, 1970, your last job at playing at White Bear Lake outside for a civic event.
And sounds right. If you say so, I'll agree with you, Tom. And